On March 29th, six women held a sit-in in Indian Affairs Minister Chuck Strahl's office, demanding that funding be restored to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. The foundation, which funded over 130 programs for Aboriginal survivors of violence and abuse in the residential school system, did not have its funding renewed in the latest federal budget. This announcement comes just about a year after the Canadian government's official apology to victims of residential schools. These cuts affected organizations providing services for residential school survivors nationwide, including here in Atlantic Canada. This morning, I will be speaking to Maya Rolbingani, a member of Missing Justice Montreal and one of the participants of the sit-in protesting the cuts. I will also be speaking to Terry Hewitt, the project coordinator at the Aboriginal Survivors for Healing, an organization on Prince Edward Island that was funded by the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. First up, we'll hear from Maya Rolbingani on the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation and the sit-in. So I just wanted to start off by talking a bit about the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. Mm-hmm. So what is the impact that those cuts will have on survivors of residential schools?
Well, the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, which was established in 1998, funded 134 Native-run, community-based healing initiatives across the country called Canada. And, I mean, all sorts of different projects, community-based, frontline, on-the-ground projects, from, you know, some of them were funding women's shelters, Native women's shelters. Others were funding different sorts of counseling for survivors of residential schools, from anger management to services provided to sexual offenders themselves. To just you name it, there was all every sort of program out there was existing, and I mean basically. Most of the directors of projects that I've spoken to had no clue that the funding was going to be cut, so they weren't prepared for it in any way. The reasons for which most people were not prepared are many and complicated. The Aboriginal Healing Foundation was evaluated on numerous occasions. The most notable of which was actually a government-commissioned study that was done only a few months ago in December, and actually a second study was done and released the day after the cuts took effect on March 31st, 2010. And both of them praised the Aboriginal Healing Foundation to such a degree and talked about how, you know, concluded that no other organization could do this sort of work with the same rate of success as the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, and not only praised the fact that they were doing such amazing work and that they were, you know, their enrollment was up 40%, people in communities were really benefiting from a lot of these services, from sexual assault counseling to whatever else, a lot of the services were really sort of actually saving lives. You know, suicide prevention was also included among them. And hard to reach sectors of the Native community were being successfully targeted as well, such as men and youth. And so they concluded all of these things in this government study not long before the cuts took effect. And they also concluded that most of the projects, the 134 projects, would probably not survive without the Aboriginal Healing Foundation funding. And they went further to even praise the fiscal organizational aspects of the organization, and the audits were exemplary and so on. So it wasn't like there was any funny business going on with the finances or anything like that. And then they actually made a recommendation to the federal government to continue to renew the funding at the very, very, very least until the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement was up, which is in 2011. And the settlement agreement is basically an agreement that gives small monetary compensation to survivors of residential schools, which I'm not knocking, which I think is great on its own level. People get a few thousand dollars if they're a proven, you know, survivor of residential schools. But the actual on-the-ground programs that were doing a world of good in a lot of people's lives were basically interrupted midstream on March 31st when the cuts took effect. And this, the impact that this has on a lot of individual people's lives, as well as the lives of communities, Native communities in general, because a lot of them were community-based, is just really, really, really damaging and really traumatic for a lot of people. Not only that, but a lot of people that were accessing these services were just beginning to make progress, and a lot of people were just beginning to be able to talk about what they'd experienced in residential schools. And this is just like, you know, taking the rug out from under them. Another reason that this was as damaging as it was and is as damaging as it is, because people are in the middle of closing the doors in a lot of cases to a lot of these organizations that were doing this work. They're like, a lot of them are closing down right now if they haven't already, because they've lost the majority, if not all, of their funding. You know, the budget, the throne speech that was given before the budget, and even the budget itself, which was presented on March 4th, 2010, was extremely misleading in the sort of language that it used, such that a lot of people that I've spoken to at the AHF itself just really just did not expect this. They were shocked. So the sort of language that was used was such that, you know, the Canadian government's going to pledge $199 million to addressing the legacy of residential schools, and a large part of this is going to go to, you know, mental and emotional health services or something along those lines. People at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation heard that, saw that, and thought, well, that's us. We're covered. It's going to be fine. We're getting our funding. And that, along with the fact that they had received nothing but rave reviews from different government parties and from the study that I mentioned earlier. But then we find out not long after, this is after, you know, the media hears this, the media hears about the $199 million and covers it in such a way that, you know, they're like, okay, well, this funding's being renewed, there's no scandal here whatsoever. And then a week or so later, when people start to find out where the money's actually going, I think it was actually more than a week, it comes out that the money's actually going half to Health Canada, government program. Basically with the expectation that Health Canada is somehow going to, replace what the Aboriginal Healing Foundation was providing, which, you know, it's been acknowledged, even in the study I mentioned earlier, the government study, that Health Canada provides different sorts of services to Native communities. You know, they have a First Nations and Inuit health branch, but by no means are they going to provide the culturally specific services that the Aboriginal Healing Foundation did. So, like, you know, a program under the Aboriginal Healing Foundation might prescribe a sweat lodge ceremony for somebody that needs it, but there's no way that Health Canada is going to. And on top of that, the Aboriginal Healing Foundation programs will definitely have more further reach into Native communities. Whereas Health Canada, they're just absent in a lot of the places that people require these services. And it's been acknowledged by politicians and grassroots activists alike that the sorts of services that are provided in these two places are complementary, but by no means do they do the same thing. So the money has been completely ripped from the Aboriginal Healing Foundation and is going to Health Canada instead. This is problematic on a number of levels, because a lot of people that survived residential schools don't trust government programs, and rightly so. And secondly, the sort of bureaucratic process that one needs to go through to access Health Canada services is completely different than the process one had to go through to access a lot of the services that AHF programs were providing. The list of problems is really long. And then, so half is going to Health Canada, and the other half of that $199 million is going to the settlement agreement that basically provides, you know, small monetary compensation to those that can prove they were in a residential school. And the on-the-ground frontline work that's being done, that was doing amazing stuff, exists no more. So that's, like, the basic background on why, you know, what was going on with the budget cuts and the Aboriginal Healing Foundation and what prompted our action. And it's not even as though, you know, it's not even as though, it's one of those things where actually the majority of MPs in Parliament, with the exception of the Conservatives, of course, were actually well-educated on the matter and actually united against the cuts. You know, I mean, the day after we did the sit-in, there was a six-hour emergency debate called in Parliament where everybody, NDP, Bloc Québécois, and Liberals alike, none of whom I ever take much interest in myself, I'm not a party politics person, but they were all, you know, just saying how much of a disaster this would be if the cuts took effect, and it just didn't make any difference whatsoever, because the very next day, the cuts took effect, and a lot of places closed down, and the place closest to me, the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, lost a third of their funding, lost three employees, including the sexual assault counselor, even though the majority of the women that they serve, over 200 women, have been sexually assaulted. And now they're able to provide food and shelter, and that's it. I'm just really appalled at what the government, you know, says its priorities are, which are, you know, missing and murdered Native women and survivors of residential school, and what they've actually shown to be true with this last budget and with their every action. Anyway, I'll stop there for that.
Okay, well, you and the other members of the sit-in, can you hear me, Maya?
Yeah.
Okay, so you and the other members of the sit-in were all members of Missing Justice, is that correct?
Yeah.
So, and your mandate is to take action on missing and murdered Indigenous women, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you see the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation as relating to that mandate?
Well, we've made lots of links in our organizing with Native communities in and around Montreal. So people in Ganawage, in Ottawa, in Kitigan-Zibi, Barrier Lake, and other places, and have been slowly forging links with communities in the city of Montreal as well, and the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal sort of sent an emergency call out when they found out that their funding was getting cut, and the communities that access the Native women that are accessing the shelter services are in every way are from a lot of the same communities of women that are targets of violence and of communities that we're trying to work with. And there's a huge overlap. I mean, the very issue of missing and murdered Native women is highly, highly affected by the fact that a lot of people in the communities which are seeing the highest rates of violence against Native women are also full of people that survived residential schools, and you can't escape the causal relationship between the two. And a lot of women that have gone missing or been murdered have been survivors of residential schools themselves, or the children of survivors of residential schools. One or the other, and the intergenerational impacts are just really, really, really strong. We saw as linked in every single way, and if the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal loses their funding, then that highly impacts our work as well. We really wanted to support them, and we recognized that they were only one of 134 organizations that were losing their funding, the total sum of damage in the end is just hard to grasp, considering that the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal on its own being cut seemed like an appalling level of damage. Mm-hmm. So we in consultation with them and in consultation with other affected communities, including people involved in the AHF themselves, who couldn't take action on their own because it's written into their funding agreement that they're not allowed to do any sort of political advocacy. and in consultation with other directly affected people who, for one reason or another, couldn't take such an action themselves, but, you know, approved of it. We took this action, and we saw it as a complementary action to other actions that had already been taken by Native communities, such as petitions that had been being circulated, such as open letters, such as government lobbying, and so on. But none of these had succeeded in convincing the conservative government to renew the funding. So we took it to the next level, in the hopes of getting, you know, more media attention and raising the profile of the issue for average people that might not have known about it yet.
And so, what was that successful? What was the reaction to your action? I know you were all arrested, and I understand that you had no response.
I mean, we did the sit-in in the hallway outside of Chuck Strahl's office because, for various reasons, we couldn't get inside. I would say it was. Yeah, I would say it was successful. Fairly successful. It definitely wasn't a failure. I don't think that it took anything away from the fight. I think it added to it. I think it was sort of appalling how quickly the whole action escalated. We were six women, and I think it had some effect on how the police, who happened to all be men, and white men at that, came in and treated us. In past things I've been involved in, the level of escalation has been much slower. We were basically, once security caught on and so on, and once they called the police, RCMP and OPP showed up pretty quickly, and then because the RCMP, they basically told us, you know, you have 30 seconds to leave or we're going to arrest you. And that was sort of shocking to us because we thought we didn't expect it to happen that quickly. And, you know, we tried to, you know, we said we were going to sit there until Chuck Strahl pledged to renew funding to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. We stood our ground, but they really meant what they said about the 30 seconds, and they ended up physically removing all of us after that time was up, so 30 seconds. And, by that time, we'd already gotten word out to the media and so on. They took us down to the basement of the Confederation building instead of to jail, strangely, and processed us all in the same building and fined us all $65 and banned us from Parliament for a year, which a friend of one of the other members involved in the sit-in later compared to being banned from smelling farts for a year, which I keep having to repeat because I think it's really funny. In any case, we were then escorted to the sidewalk and told which side of the line was belonging to Parliament and which side of the line we were allowed to be on. And then there was a small support rally happening outside, so we joined them. APTN was out there. I mean, there were basically about 15 or so media articles generated about this across the country, which is, you know, not that much if you're thinking that it's all across the country and not bad at the same time. And then a few radio and one TV interview, CBC Yellowknife. In that sense, the fact that there was any media attention at all was a success, in my opinion. Most of the articles were decent and had the issues straight. They mistook us for Native protesters because we didn't specify that we were, you know, non-Native. We assumed the media wouldn't assume things about us, but that was silly, and in the future we'll have to specify. But in the end, a lot of them corrected that mistake, and I don't think that really got in the way of the message and what was going on. And then the very next day, I'm not sure if our action contributed to it or not, but the very next day there was an emergency debate about the AHF funding called in Parliament, and that gave a chance to a lot of MPs to get really, really, really riled up about it, and I thought maybe it would make a difference. And I think it might still. I mean, the funding's been cut and so on, but a lot of people are still, you know, fighting and lobbying for the funding to be renewed. So who knows? I definitely think it added to raising the overall profile of the issue, and hopefully will contribute to an eventual renewing, contribute to the case for eventually renewing the funding. And another important thing about the fact that we are non-Native supporters supporting this cause, which I brought up in later media interviews, once a lot of the media had realized that we were in fact solidarity supporters and not from directly affected communities ourselves. I think it's really important, and I made a case for this in various interviews, to express exactly why it is that it's really, really important and significant for non-Native communities to show their support, and to express why it is that all people in Canada, all residents, should be concerned about these issues, not just Native people. I mean, when any sector of the population is, when their health and safety are under threat, then everybody should be concerned. And when survivors of residential schools from Native communities in this country are under threat, and and life or death situations are being taken lightly, then everybody should be concerned, no matter what color or culture you're from. So that was basically what I saw as the importance of expressing why it's important that we are non-Native. And if it had been Native people doing it, it would have been important for different reasons. Anyhow, that's...
Well, Maya, do you have any advice if people are listening to this and are concerned about this issue and want to take action? Do you have any advice about the kinds of actions that can be taken?
Yeah, there was information sent out in our press release, and I think it's still on our site on missingjustice.ca. Well, there's basically we have Chuck Stahl's phone number and fax number, and same as, and also Stephen Harper's. But I would suggest that people phone up Chuck Stahl's office as often as possible to express concerns about this and to insist that he pledged to renew the funding. The more people that do that, the more annoying it is for them. And if people do it, if enough people do it on a sustained basis, then it actually does sometimes affect the decisions that these people make. Besides that, I don't think that on its own is necessarily enough. Besides that, I would say that getting a hold of the AHS, of people that work at the AHS themselves, as well as programs and projects in their own communities that have been affected by the AHS cuts, to find out what sorts of future actions and pressure tactics they want to see happen. Because, I mean, I'm pretty sure that most people in Canada live fairly close to at least one project that has either had to close their doors in the last couple of weeks or has suffered immensely. And I would suggest that getting in touch with those projects on a local level and figuring out what they want to see happen next is a really smart next step. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thanks.
That would be the most important thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks so much, Maya. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Let's see. I guess I would just add that it's important to draw the links between the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, missing and murdered Native women in this country, poverty on Native reserves and communities, the countless land struggles that Native communities across Canada are engaged in right now with provincial and federal governments, and just really see how they're all connected, and just to, take note of the sort of policies that our government is engaged in and the sort of priorities they say that they have, but then the sort of where they're actually putting their money and where they're actually putting their resources and what their true motivations are for protecting some pieces of land and not others, and so on. And I mean, just looking at the 2010 budget alone, you can see that not only was the Aboriginal Healing Foundation cut, completely cut, but Sisters in Spirit, which is a program of the Native Women, which is a campaign of the Native Women's Association of Canada, which has done, you know, amazing, groundbreaking research in the last 5 years on the numbers of missing and murdered Native women in this country, and have only begun to really make progress because they've had all sorts of barriers up against the research they were doing, including not even enough funding, have now had their funding cut entirely in the last budget. And similar to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, an ambiguous $10 million was allotted to dealing with the issue of missing and murdered Native women, but you know, it's not going to Sisters in Spirit, so far as anyone knows yet. The government is supposed to make some sort of announcement at some point when, you know, when, nobody knows, but they're, you know, they've said that they don't want to fund research anymore, so they've taken it away from Sisters in Spirit, and they've said that they want to now fund action instead, but they haven't said how they're going to fund that action, who it's going to go to do that work. And many people are just suspecting that the way they're going to fund the action is to increase police presence on reserves. So you have to really look at what the government's saying and what they're doing, and how different those things are. And then you also have, of course, First Nations University, which you know, is losing all of their funding at the end of the school year, even though they've, you know, come up with all sorts of plans to better the operation of their school. And anyway, just making the links, I guess, and holding the Canadian government accountable at every possible turn on whatever issue, because they're all linked. So I guess I'd leave it at that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much for speaking with me, Maya. So as Maya mentioned, the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation were national in scope and have affected organizations across the country, including here on the East Coast. So I'm on the line with Terry Hewitt, and Terry Hewitt is the project coordinator at Aboriginal Survivors for Healing, which is a program that was funded by the Aboriginal Healing Foundation on Prince Edward Island. They've been funded since the year 2000 and are the only organization on the island that was funded by the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. So I'm going to speak to Terry a little bit about her opinion on the cuts and the way it has affected her organization's operations. Thanks so much for joining us, Terry.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jane.
So can you start by telling us a little bit about the services that were offered by traditional holistic healing and the impacts that the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation will have on your ability to provide services?
ASH, which stands for Aboriginal Survivors for Healing, has been operating on Prince Edward Island since the year 2000. And we have been providing traditional-based healing services to survivors and their families in the province since that time. We have been, up till March 31st, the only Aboriginal Healing Foundation-funded project on the island. And we are the only organization that has been providing regular traditional based healing services in the province. As a result, the impact of the funding cuts are significant on Prince Edward Island because of the lack of alternatives. I can't speak for other provinces in the Maritimes, whether or not there are regular traditional based healing services available, but certainly we know that here on Prince Edward Island, we were the only one doing that kind of thing. During the years that the Aboriginal Healing Foundation operated and provided funding for various projects across Canada, its research showed that residential school survivors and descendants, which describes their family members, respond more positively to traditional-based healing methods than to conventional services, although certainly survivors that use our services and spend time at our office may use either just traditional-based healing services or conventional or a combination of both.
So I'm wondering, you mentioned that you're the only service provider on the island. I'm wondering if you can speak to the need for this kind of program, specifically for survivors of residential schools, and what kinds of services you provide and why those are so important.
Well, we're the only organization providing traditionally based healing services, and that's in the form of separate men's and women's healing circles weekly. Our traditional counselor also leads sweat lodges, usually on a weekly basis, at one of the First Nations here on Prince Edward Island, and that frequently follows the women's circle, although it's open to men and women. The traditional counselor also works one-on-one, particularly with people referred from provincial agencies and departments where more intensive work might be required for the individual before they're able to enter the circle and to participate in that kind of format. So over the years, we've had a lot of referrals from provincial services for traditional healing. It's our observation that traditional healing, which involves rekindling of traditional culture, is key to restoring a positive sense of identity in survivors and descendants, which had been lost or severely damaged during the period of the residential school system and following that, because, of course, individuals left those schools without parenting skills, some having experienced both physical and sexual abuse, many being separated from their families and their cultures. So that is the connection between the need for healing services and what happened during the residential school period, which and the effects of which ripple through First Nation communities to this day. I'm not sure if I fully answered your question, Jane. If there's some parts that I haven't, please go back to it.
Okay. No, that was great. Thank you so much. I'm wondering, I understand that there's speculation that some of the funding that was being used, that was going to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, is going to be funneled to Health Canada. Now, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether Health Canada will be able to provide traditional healing services as effectively as more independently funded projects.
Well, I just to go back to that statement, the budget, as I understand it, that was brought down in Ottawa March 4th, essentially set out $199 million to Health Canada to address survivor needs. Now, not all of that is earmarked to provide support to formerly funded AHF projects, but some of it is, and a significant amount is, and I can speak to that because we are in the process of negotiating with Health Canada to access some of the funding under that particular block. The problem is that although Health Canada in its mandate to distribute these dollars can fund certain components of a project, they cannot fund the honoraria, for example, to the board of directors. And in our case, the board of directors is composed of survivors and descendants to ensure that the project is survivor-driven and sensitive to the needs of survivors. Nor will it fund project coordinator salaries nor administrative support salaries. So essentially what it's doing, or essentially what is a result of the way this money has been channeled, is that it takes out the survivor-driven component and has the potential to remove from these projects those staff that over the years have become sensitive to survivor needs and understand the full impacts of the residential school system. So that is essentially the difference. Some components can be funded under Health Canada, but others that were funded by the Aboriginal Healing Project, they can't provide dollars to support.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Terry. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Yes, I would. Because this project has been has received referrals over the years from the province of Prince Edward Island, we approached the provincial government with a view to getting a small amount of funding to kind of close that gap between what Health Canada is able to provide to us to continue services and what we need to sustain the program as it has been operating. And to date, the response has been very negative. And we feel very strongly that the province has a role to play in sustaining these services, because certainly it is referring clients, and these, of course, are off-reserve clients. They're referring clients to our services, but they aren't willing at this point to step up and provide some funding to follow that. And we're hopeful that with continued pressure, the province might change its mind on that point.
And what about the federal government? Do you see any prospect for the federal government changing its mind and restoring funding to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation?
I have no idea. There has been a lot of buzz. There was the emergency debate, I believe it was March 29th, that took place in the House of Commons in Ottawa, led by Nikki Ashton from the NDP. And following that, there was a story on CBC that I picked up on the internet saying that the Prime Minister was meeting that day with Aboriginal leaders around the issue of reinstatement of Aboriginal Healing Foundation dollars. And I have heard nothing since, and in spite of trying to tap out my resources. So whether there's still some negotiation taking place on that point or not, I don't know. And I'm also waiting to see what happens when the budget is presented to the House, and whether or not there have been any changes, because, of course, at this point it hasn't been passed in Ottawa. So, I mean, it's a kind of faint hope that we're holding out that there may be some change on the part of the government, having realized, you know, that there's a fairly significant public outcry on the withdrawal of funding for the foundation. But I'm just very cautiously optimistic on that point.
What do you think that the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation say about the Canadian government's priorities with respect to, I guess, Aboriginal people in Canada in general, but also survivors of residential schools?
Well, personally, I was surprised. I thought that when the Prime Minister delivered his apology, and I was in Ottawa with some survivors the day that that happened, I felt it was a very sincere apology, and I felt that he got it. I felt that the Conservative government had kind of turned a corner in its relationships with First Nations in this country, and I feel that not refunding the Aboriginal Healing Foundation is short-sighted and speaks to a lack of a full understanding on the part of the Conservative government as to the effects of the residential school system present day and its obligations to address that. I mean, the residential school system was in operation for decades, and the effects are not going to be addressed in 10 or 15 years. It does require more funding. I'm hopeful that, you know, they will revisit this, that they will see that, you know, they have made a mistake. And otherwise, I mean, I think that that's where I stand now. I'm just waiting to see what happens next and when the next shoe drops.
Okay, so just to finish up, I was just wondering if anybody's listening to this who is concerned about these cuts, if you have any suggestions about what they could do to help.
Well, although several petitions had been circulated right after before and after the budget was brought down, certainly around the time of the emergency debate on March 29th, we and others had written to MPs, it doesn't hurt to approach your local member of parliament to write a letter to the Prime Minister. I think there are still some petitions circulating online that people can sign to show their support for reinstatement of Aboriginal Healing Foundation funding. And, you know, those are probably the most direct means to use to show support for ongoing funding for the foundation.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Terry. Do you have any closing thoughts?
No, you're quite welcome. I just really appreciate this opportunity, Jane, to revisit this issue again, because as much as it's kind of fallen off the radar screen, there are 135 Aboriginal Healing Foundation projects across Canada scrambling to try to keep their doors open, and I know many of them will close, and you know, we're hopeful that we'll continue, we likely will, but in a kind of scaled-down manner. So I think it's really important that this issue be maintained in public consciousness, you know, at least until we're sure that the federal government's made a final decision. So thanks so much for the opportunity to discuss this point. I appreciate it, Jane.
So again, that was Terry Hewitt, the project coordinator at Aboriginal Survivors for Healing, and before that, Maya Robingani of Missing Justice in Montreal, both speaking about the cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, both nationally and here on the East Coast, and those programs are going to have pretty severe impacts on the survivors of the residential school system from the sounds of it. So again, if anybody is interested in looking for more information, there are links to a petition and more media coverage and information that can be found on the website of Missing Justice, which is found at www.missingjustice.ca.